All right, the next matter on the calendar is State versus Lee Daniel Williams. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument. And please feel free to adjust the podium in accordance with your height.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gina Schultz. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Lee Williams, the appellant in this matter. After 11 successful years on probation, Williams was violated and revoked based on hearsay evidence that was admitted in violation of the minimum requirements.
Well, I don't know if I would refer to them, Ms. Schultz, as successful.
The first 11 years?
I apologize. So the three instances were all post 11 years?
Yes. The first violation was, I believe, 11 years and 1 month into his probation.
Okay. Well.
So is he the poster child for the sentencing guidelines?
So the last 4 years, you get a pass. Well, I don't know. Thank God probation will be capped in 5 years now. So there you go.
That would certainly be good news for Mr. Williams. But because the district court abused its discretion in admitting this hearsay evidence without making any kind of analysis on reliability or necessity, this court must reverse the district court's order revoking his probation.
But you agree that hearsay evidence is admissible in a probation revocation hearing so long as it's reliable and necessary?
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor.
All right.
Let's talk about the standard of review, because although there was an objection to that letter coming in, there wasn't a specific objection.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
Where in the transcript, can you point me to where there was a specific, my client's confrontation rights are being violated?
Well, on page 15 of the probation revocation hearing transcript, the Williams counsel said objection hearsay. And because
But you know that when you object on hearsay grounds, you're supposed to give a specific reason so that there can be review and the judge can say, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should sustain or deny that.
Well, I think in this case, I guess I have two answers to that. One is that the hearsay objection, I mean, because the law is absolutely clear that hearsay is only admissible if it's reliable and necessary, the hearsay objection encompassed that that justification. I think, secondly, the district court ruled on the objection without any further discussion. And so I think Williams' counsel didn't really have an opportunity to argue any more specific grounds after the initial objection.
Are you familiar with the Rosberg case out of the Supreme Court, Minnesota Supreme Court?
I'm not, Your Honor.
And in that case, the court said, unless a timely objection or motion to strike appears of record stating the specific ground of objection, if the specific ground was not apparent from the context, appellate courts will not consider the challenge to the admission of that evidence?
Well, I think here the specific ground was clear from the context because
I don't know that confrontation was clear from the context. I'm trying to understand where in the record we would find that.
Well, I think my argument is that it's absolutely clear under both the rules of evidence and under Johnson that hearsay on its own isn't an adequate objection. That if you're objecting on hearsay grounds, it's because it's not necessary and reliable, because that's the only reason that hearsay wouldn't come in.
What do you do with, let's talk about Johnson next. So the court in that case looked at the rule, looked at other jurisdictions' interpretations of the rule, and then said, in line with these cases, we conclude that when the defendant has had an ample opportunity to present evidence in a probation revocation proceeding, the rules of evidence do not preclude admission of hearsay evidence, such as a letter report, reporting that defendant violated the terms of probation. Affording the defendant the opportunity to present evidence ensures that the defendant can expose potential flaws in the evidence. And in this case, your client did testify. And so how do you apply Johnson in our context?
Yeah, Your Honor. I've got a couple of responses to that. First is that, I mean, the holding of Johnson is that the rules of evidence don't preclude admission of hearsay, and we're in complete agreement with that. You know, the case that the state cited in its brief, State v. Belts, this court said in Johnson they brought out, you know, they discussed rules, general confrontation principles, but then held that under the rules of evidence, hearsay is inadmissible. So I think applying Johnson here, Johnson's correct when it said that hearsay is only admissible if it's necessary and reliable. But the holding is that the rules of evidence don't preclude it. And so that's not enough to end the analysis here.
And do you think that the rule enunciated in Johnson that if the probationer presents evidence or testifies, that vindicates his or her rights?
I don't, Your Honor. Under Morrissey, the Supreme Court was absolutely clear that if you're not going to allow confrontation, then there has to be a good cause finding. And Johnson said it has to be necessary and reliable. And looking at all the other jurisdictions that have good cause tests, that is fully in line with that. And so if it were the case that as long as the defendant is able to, or the probationer is allowed to present evidence, then any hearsay can come in, then there's no limits. Any hearsay can come in because the defendant is always able to present their own. But even, I'm sorry, Judge Hoot.
Well, can I ask you, because this is a discharge summary from the DORS program at the workhouse, right?
Yes,
Your Honor.
That's
what we're talking about, right? Is there, I mean, what is there that indicates that this is an unreliable document? I mean, there's always discharge documents in these cases, and this one came from a specific program that was part of the workhouse programming. Why, are you arguing that document in and of itself is unreliable?
I'm arguing that there was absolutely no showing that it was reliable. I think it could have been. It's certainly possible, but
wasn't it identified as a discharge summary from that program?
It was identified as a discharge summary.
Sufficient? I mean, what more would you want? I mean, are you going to require all of these, administrators of these programs come in for every revocation hearing when it's clear what it is and where it came from?
Yes, unless the discharge report is reliable and necessary. And it's possible that the district court could have made those findings here. If the district court would have inquired and we had some foundation to say, okay, this is who this counselor is. This was her relationship to Williams. The report was based on her interactions with him, not on notes from some other counselor or...
Was there any dispute here that he was discharged from the program?
No.
All right, so that's not really an issue. So the issue is his comments that he made in conjunction with that discharge summary or that discharge report. Is that correct?
Yes, it was the counselor's characterization of his comments, but also her subjective impressions of him and her conclusions about his behavior. And
well, didn't he testify regarding those statements that he supposedly made?
He did, but the district court here looked at the discharge summary and said,
You lose.
What you're saying doesn't comport with this discharge.
The probation officer was not. I'm sorry. Is it the DORS program? I mean, I don't really know these. Is it the DORS program?
The DORS program. Yes.
And she didn't work at the DORS program.
No.
So it's not just the question of why he was discharged, but the attitude issue. And she certainly was unfamiliar with the attitude issue.
I agree. The probation officer didn't have any contact with Williams between the second and third violation hearings. And there's no indication she had any contact with the woman who wrote the discharge report. So at this point, I mean, there was really, under Johnson, his ability to present evidence and to challenge this report is basically non-existent because every time he said something that contradicted the report, the judge said, well, there's this report. So I don't believe what you're saying. And here to have any kind of meaningful opportunity to expose flaws in this evidence, he needed to be able to cross-examine her, to ask her questions about, okay, well, you know, what was the context of this statement? Did he say this exactly? What was your relationship to him? All of those questions that would shed light on its
why
initial...
Why he got terminated.
Right, exactly. And that goes both to the initial reliability analysis for admission, but also in terms of weight. And here, it's a cold document. The judge didn't have any reason to find it credible or not credible. And yet, the whole revocation order is really premised on this document because there's no other evidence outside of it regarding his behavior between the second and third violation hearings when he was in custody at the workhouse.
How is this case different than the factual situation in State v. Johnson?
In a couple of reasons. One, the letter in State v. Johnson was a letter from one probation officer to another. Johnson had transferred from one county to another. And the letter said that he had not been attending the Mothers Against Drunk Driving victim impact class that he was supposed to be attending. And then his current probation officer gave foundation for this letter and was able to be cross-examined regarding it, and it was admitted for that limited purpose of saying he didn't comply with this condition. This court said, you know, you're able to ask the probation officer. It's very easy to present your own evidence and say, no, I have been there. I can show you my attendance log or something like that. So factually, it's very different. But I would say also legally, it's very different in the sense that the parties in that case didn't argue due process confrontation rights. The parties argued confrontation rights under the Sixth Amendment. And the analysis is slightly different. Even the court is absolutely correct in Johnson when it says that hearsay isn't admissible if it's not reliable and necessary. So here, unlike Johnson, where we have a straightforward, simple letter with a easily rebuttable assertion, we have a discharge summary with multiple subjective impressions, ambiguous statements that no one's there to, that there's no one there to explain, and we have no other evidence regarding his behavior besides the summary.
Well, can I ask you this? If in fact he was discharged and there's no dispute about that, does it really matter? I mean, how is he prejudiced here? I mean, because if he's been discharged out of a program he was ordered to complete, isn't that enough? I mean, how is there prejudice here?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Right.
First of all, because if you look at the probation agreement that he signed in February 2018, the order was complete treatment. It wasn't complete treatment at this program. It wasn't, you know, take the first recommendation that comes along. It was complete treatment. And here we have evidence in the record that he took the Rule 25, got this recommendation, did some research into it, decided it did not seem like a good fit for him, started contacting other programs when he did not have any success in, like, reaching out because he was in custody. He decided, okay, let's give it a shot. He gave it a shot, decided it wasn't a good fit, left, but then he immediately started contacting other programs. And we have even a letter to the district court that he wrote saying, please let me go to Lakeshore Meridian. It's a good fit for me. I need to do this because I want to get my child back. And then he testified at the hearing that he needs treatment. He's wanted treatment. He struggled for the last... He was a person who was extremely stable for 11 years and then started struggling with chemical dependency issues and everything.
Ms. Schultz, I do have some sympathy. He doesn't seem to be your typical person who just kind of, you know, never scheduled the Rule 25 and just, you know, never did anything. But, you know, getting to the finding on, you know, an intentional violation, I guess one concern I would have would be if we were to agree with you and reverse this decision, I'll be candid. I would be concerned that people on probation would always be saying, well, you know, that's not a good fit for me. I don't want to go to, you know, the DAP program. I I'm going to try this program. And it's sort of like, you know, there aren't that many programs. Well, I mean, maybe there are a lot of programs. I don't know. But it's sort of like it would almost sort of shift the burden as to, well, no, you got a complete probation, and it's this probation, not the one that you think is a good fit for you. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess I have two responses to that. First is that, you know, if probation, if the state would have called this counselor and she said everything that she said in the discharge summary, she said he was completely uncooperative, he said he didn't want treatment, he blew everything off, you know, told me he only wanted, there could be many details that would show that, hey, he's just not complying with this condition. But I think the second thing is that, you know, treatment isn't just like going to the doctor. It is something that you need a good fit. It requires you to be vulnerable and share a lot of traumatic things. And I see my time is running out, but I can address more of this.
I'm sure Judge Hooten will let you finish your thought.
I will.
I think treatment, it is important to find a good fit. It's not, they're not all created the same, and it requires people to do really hard work. So I think it's not the worst thing for people to try to find something good. Until rebuttal, we would ask this court to reverse the district court's order.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent in the state of Minnesota in this matter. There's 6 points I want to make today, starting with the fact that appellant did not object when this report was admitted. Now, it's true that later he objected to a question about the report, but he never followed up and said, oh, and by the way, you shouldn't even look at the report. The report should be struck. He never mentioned the phrase confrontation clause. He never asked Judge Starr to find reliability or necessity or good cause. So clearly plain error analysis applies here, because clearly Judge Starr was not confronted with a confrontation clause objection or any motion to exclude or strike or not admit this report.
Well, is there any issue, any issue in this record as to the fact that this was a reliable document in that it came from this administrator of this program?
No, Your Honor, and that was going to be point number five for me, which is that if you get that far into the analysis, this was a reliable report. It's an official government report. It's not, I heard whispering in the cell next to me, and this is what I thought they said. There's no case law that suggests something like this isn't reliable. Now, appellant attacks it as ambiguous or lacking in detail, but that goes to weight. That doesn't go to admissibility. But you don't even need to get that far, because point number one is clearly plain error analysis applies because there's no objection. Point number two is there was no plain error here because Judge Starr followed Johnson. And I'll talk a little more about Johnson in a second, but Johnson upheld the admission of hearsay just like Judge Starr did here. It can't be plain error for a district court judge to follow a published decision of this court. That's what district court judges have to do. District court judges can't say, well, I disagree with that decision's analysis of Supreme Court precedent, so I'm not going to follow it. And the Supreme Court precedent that appellant relies on here predates Johnson, and it's cited in Johnson. Johnson was aware of Morrissey and Gagnon. Johnson discusses the Confrontation Clause. So it can't have been plain error for Judge Starr not to have to follow Johnson, and she was never asked not to.
Isn't the issue, Mr. Raggetts, it's the issue is not, and as I understand it, perhaps I'm wrong, you know, what distinguishes this as Johnson is not the fact that there's a letter or report saying he was terminated from treatment. It's the editorial comments in terms of his willingness. You know, he was a deadbeat, he was a loser. And doesn't that make it a little different from Johnson?
Well, it's factually not identical with Johnson. But the holding in Johnson, I was going to read to this court, but this court's already read it, so I'm not going to bother with that. But Johnson says hearsay is admissible as long as you have a chance to attack it. And he had every chance to attack it here. He was on notice that there would only be one witness at this probation revocation hearing, his probation officer. He was on notice that the report would be submitted. He could have called, he could have subpoenaed and called the DRS person to testify.
Well, you know, he could have done that, but you know, you had the burden, so why didn't you call the DRS person to say, what a deadbeat?
Because Johnson says that we didn't have to, and there was never any objection or request of that from appellant. And this
well,
is jumping.
Does Johnson say, well, maybe it's my understanding that hearsay is admissible, but there is some basis for reliability. Am I close?
Johnson uses language about reliability, but Johnson's ultimate conclusion, which this court has already read, is when the defendant has ample opportunity to present evidence in a probation revocation proceeding, hearsay is admissible. Appellant had ample opportunity to present evidence. He was not precluded in any way. He never asked to call anyone or testify about anything or introduce any evidence and was told no. So you can't square Johnson with appellant's argument, because under appellant's argument, Johnson should have said there was no finding of reliability, therefore the hearsay shouldn't have come in. That's not what Johnson held. And this court has,
appellant talks about Morrissey a lot in her brief and in the rebuttal brief. So how do you respond to her arguments that under Morrissey, the right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses is one of the minimum requirements for a parole revocation?
Well, Morrissey says you need good cause to admit hearsay. And Johnson looked at Morrissey and Gagnon and essentially said there's good cause to admit hearsay when the appellant is not, or the probationer is not, restricted in any way in his ability to attack that hearsay. So again, appellant's really arguing you should overturn Johnson because Johnson misinterpreted Morrissey. But it wasn't plain error for Judge Starr to follow Johnson. If there had been an objection, that would be a different matter. But we're talking about plain error here.
How would Mr. Williams at the hearing, how would he have attacked the editorial comments made by someone who wasn't present and who the probation officer, you know, had no interaction with? How would that cross-examination be?
He could have subpoenaed her to be there, so he could question her.
Now we're dealing with on cross-examination, what would the attacking questions been to the probation officer about the editorial comments in the discharge report?
Oh, I see. Well, he did testify that I didn't say those things. Here's what I said, and that was a credibility determination for Judge Starr, and she did not find him credible.
Make a credibility determination on an editorial comment when the person who made the comment is not on the stand, and the person who is on the stand didn't write the comment.
Well, what she is.
I find it, you know, that's really credible handwriting.
She's finding that his testimony is not credible, and she had good reason not to find him credible. He's saying, I didn't say that stuff. Here's what I actually said. But he's also saying, I tried to get into all these other programs, but every time I showed up, they were closed early. I left all these voicemails. No one ever called me back. He's made a lot of incredible statements already. But I think the ultimate point here is all these editorial comments go to whether it was excusable that he bailed out of this program. But the Austin requirement is intentional or excusable. And here, there is no dispute that he intentionally left this program he was ordered to do. Appellant concedes that on page 23 of the brief, and appellant himself testified, I voluntarily left this program. I didn't feel like it was a good fit. Well, that wasn't his call to make. He was ordered to get treatment in the workhouse, and he flatly refused. You can't not show up at Moose Lake Prison and say, I think Lionel Lakes would be a better fit, so I'm not showing up. That's essentially what he did here. That wasn't his call. He had to make a good faith effort to complete this program, and he decided, I don't like it, I'm not going to do it. He admitted that. So he admitted the intentionality, and so therefore, whether it was excusable or not is irrelevant. That's where there's no prejudice here, because he was ordered to complete treatment at the workhouse, and he didn't do it. And he had a history of that. I mean, if you look at his three probation violations, the three probation violation hearings, the first one, he didn't abstain, he tested positive three times, and he didn't report for testing three times. He was told to enter treatment, and he didn't. At the end of that hearing, it was agreed that if he got treatment, he would be discharged from probation early. So this is not a situation where everyone's just trying to go after appellant. They were giving him breaks. They were trying to get him off probation if he just went through treatment. But he didn't. And then he has a second probation violation hearing. Again, he hasn't abstained from drugs. He hasn't reported for testing. He was discharged from a program for failing to attend. He had some excuses about that, but he admitted that he didn't attend and he got kicked out. His probation officer testified that he was uncooperative. He himself said, yeah, I rebelled against probation. It's hard. My probation officer wasn't giving me a break. Well, no one needs to give you a break if you're doing what you're supposed to do. So then he gets 365 days in the workhouse. and he's ordered to complete treatment there. And then his third violation hearing is because he didn't complete treatment there because he didn't think it was a good fit, and so he left voluntarily. He admitted he had a problem with methamphetamine, but he said he didn't want to do any programming in the workhouse. He just wanted to wait till he got out of the workhouse, and then he'd try and get treatment. So when you put all that together, there is no prejudice here because he intentionally failed to complete treatment three times. He never completed treatment, and he admitted he has a problem with methamphetamine, and he got a dispositional departure from a gun crime in the first place. So if you get that far to the question of prejudice, there is no prejudice here. Based on that, also, there is a reliable report here. It's an official government report, but you don't even need to get that far because Judge Starr did not plainly err by following binding precedent. And this court has affirmed that precedent or followed that precedent in a number of unpublished decisions. I've only cited two of them in my brief, but one of them, Belts, is less than 6 months old. Judge Riley, you were on the panel on Olgren, which also applied Johnson. Johnson's good law, and Judge Starr appropriately followed it. And it's not appropriate for appellant now to be saying, well, Johnson's wrong under Morrissey, and so therefore Judge Starr shouldn't have followed it, especially when there was no objection like that below. This court will indulge me. I'll look at my notes for a second to see if there's anything I've missed here. And of course, I'm open to other questions. But I think that the lack of objection here is really critical because it doesn't put this court in a position to consider whether it should overrule Johnson. Appellant can, of course, always ask the Supreme Court to do that. And there simply was no mention of the Confrontation Clause below. Appellant now says, well, maybe Judge Starr could have found reliability here, but she was never asked to do that. That's the critical point. And all of these side comments about appellant's attitude are really irrelevant because, again, he admitted that he voluntarily left the program at the workhouse. And he admitted that he decided, I just want to get done with my workhouse time, and then I'll try and do treatment. I don't want to do any treatment in the workhouse. So when you put all that together and the fact that he was on notice of what was going to happen at the probation revocation hearing and didn't object or seek additional witnesses, you've got no prejudice here. And that's all I have. Unless this court has additional questions, I'll simply ask you to affirm Judge Starr.
So the record is, am I correct that the record only shows that before the district court, the only objection was hearsay?
Right. That's on page 15 of the transcript. The objection is hearsay. The prosecutor responds, the rules of evidence don't apply in a hearing like this, which is true. The defense did not follow up and say, yes, but the Confrontation Clause does, or, okay, here's my specific hearsay objection. You have to find reliability. And it's not a judge's job to sua sponte object to evidence or make findings when the defense doesn't ask for it. If the state calls an expert and the defense doesn't challenge the expert's qualifications, the judge doesn't have to sua sponte find the expert's qualified. I mean, and hearsay generally is not admissible without an exception found. But that doesn't mean in every trial, every time hearsay comes up, a judge has to sua sponte jump in and find the exception if the defense doesn't object. And here the defense never objected on Confrontation Clause ground, never asked for a finding of good cause under Morrissey, never asked for a finding of reliability. All that's been waived, and Judge Starr acted appropriately.
What if the trial counsel said hearsay and no foundation?
Then
and the judge overruled it. What would the foundation have been through this probation officer to get this discharge summary in?
Well, the rules of evidence don't apply to a probation revocation hearing, so you don't have a foundation requirement. What you have, at most, under Morrissey, is a requirement that there's good cause for letting it in, which, again, Johnson interpreted as meaning you can attack it at will. So in this case, I think Judge Starr certainly could have found, well, this is an official government report. We see these all the time. There's no reason to think it's been forged. There's no allegation like that or that the person was lying. You can, of course, attack its weight, but I'm not going to refuse to consider it just based on the fact that this person isn't here who appellant never asked to be at the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I have three main points here that I'd like to make quickly on rebuttal. The first is that we have never at any point asked this court to overrule Johnson. Johnson is absolutely consistent with Williams' argument. It's absolutely consistent with Morrissey, and it's good for Williams. Johnson says it has to be necessary and reliable, and that's what we're arguing here. I completely disagree with the state's point that Johnson looked at Morrissey, said, okay, great, there's good cause as long as the defendant can present his own evidence. Footnote one of Johnson says explicitly, typically these kinds of challenges are raised under the Due Process Clause, and that's when this court cited Morrissey. And it said, but here, the parties have argued it under the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause, and so we're not addressing that here. So the state's argument that Johnson decided that there's good cause as long as the defendant can present evidence is just incorrect. Second thing is, I completely disagree that there's no prejudice because it's clear that he intentionally left this program. The condition in his probation agreement said complete treatment. It didn't say complete this specific treatment. He took a Rule 25. Even under the terms of the Rule 25 itself, you can appeal the assessment, and that's what he did. He said, I don't want to do this one. I've heard bad things. It doesn't seem like a good fit. And he started contacting other programs. He tried this one when he wasn't able to make any contact with his probation officer or anyone else, and it wasn't a good fit. He was right. And he tried to contact other programs after that, and the state acknowledged that at the hearing when it said, well, did you know that Lakeshore isn't going to take you? And he said, no, I didn't know that. So they knew. They knew he was trying to look at other programs.
This was his third probation violation hearing because the first two times he didn't. Even though he was supposed to start treatment, he didn't.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's when he could have picked where he was going to go.
Well, and
it's harder to pick when you're in the workhouse.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But I have a couple of responses. One is that, you know, he testified at this hearing, I was on drugs and I was not in my right mind, which makes sense. Addiction is a disease, and he was not thinking clearly. And he did start the program at Resurrection Recovery. So at the first violation hearing, he hadn't entered a program. He was clearly struggling, just didn't get it done. The second one, he entered treatment at Resurrection Recovery, but then he was ultimately discharged because of attendance issues. And his testimony at that time was that I just got diagnosed with diabetes and it upended my life. I'm spending all this time at doctor's appointments and I just didn't make it. And then one of the state's allegations at that time was that he failed to enter a new treatment program. He gave his reason, and the state withdrew that allegation. So, and at that point, he was sent to the workhouse. He was in custody for 365 days. And there was only one option there. He heard from a lot of people it wasn't good, and he made every effort to find something else. So, and I think in terms of prejudice, this evidence doesn't just go to the first Austin factor. It goes to all three. So it's whether, you know, whether he actually violated the condition, whether it was intentional and inexcusable. The evidence doesn't show that here, even with this discharge summary. I think it's obviously a harder case if the discharge summary gets in, but I'm arguing that it shouldn't have. Even so, there's nothing to contradict the fact that he is trying to find other programs, and we have this letter that he wrote to the district court saying, please let me go to this other program.
You know, can I get to the prejudice prong for a moment? Because he testified, he explained everything and mm-hmm. didn't think this was a good fit, and he was looking elsewhere. I mean, he had a full opportunity to explain, you know, what his thought process was. Correct? Am I correct in that?
He had the opportunity in the sense that he was allowed to testify, but
right.
not.
And so, what more would he have been able to obtain from this person that he wasn't able to do by testifying directly and saying I didn't say this or it was taken out of context? I mean, what more could he have obtained? I mean, isn't it kind of speculative as to what he could have?
Potentially a lot more. I mean, at this point, I mean, his testimony was almost meaningless because every time he said something that undermined the report, the judge said, well, I don't believe you because there's this report. And so if the counselor was there to testify, the judge could have compared the testimony and actually made a real credibility finding. And he could have actually had the opportunity to cross-examine and expose some flaws in that evidence. I see that my time is running out.
If you want to conclude.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. We ask this court to reverse the district court's order revoking Williams' probation.
All right, very good. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you for your arguments this morning. All right, we will adjourn now so that the ITV can be set up.